Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, September 5th, 2009. I'm Harley Schlanger. I will be your host today. Well, we're now in the decisive month of September, identified by Lyndon LaRouche as the beginning of an era characterized by the final demise of the British Empire, as the monetarist imperial financial system disintegrates under the weight of trillions of dollars of uncollectible debt. Next week, there will be a showdown over this. On Tuesday, September 8th, LaRouche will deliver a webcast at 1 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, and that's available to you on the LaRouchePact.com website. And I would urge everybody listening to begin at the end of this program to call everyone you know to get them on that webcast. So that's this coming Tuesday, September 8th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on LaRouchePact.com. LaRouche will be presenting an alternative to the crash of the present system and challenges listeners to take the mass strike motion, which has dominated the news in August, to a new higher cognitive level to ensure that LaRouche's alternative can be realized. Then on Wednesday, poor old President Barack Obama is going to be thrust before a joint session of Congress. I presume they're calling it a joint session because some of them will be lighting up during the proceedings. But Obama is going to go before them to try to convince them to ignore the clear wishes of their constituents, as expressed at dozens of raucous town meetings, and instead plunge ahead with a Nazi model T4 euthanasia policy, disguised as healthcare reform, to save the bankers and their bankrupt system. The outcome of this battle between these two conceptions of economics, the Anglo-Dutch-Saudi imperial system, represented by those stroking Obama's Nero-like ego, versus Lyndon LaRouche's revival of the American system of economics, will determine the future of human civilization for the next two generations over the next half century. Today on The LaRouche Show, we'll be looking at the potential of the next 50 years if Lyndon LaRouche's leadership succeeds. Joining me are two members of the famous, or infamous, depending on your point of view, basement team, Ouyang Teng and Peter Martinson. They have been involved in producing material on the website, including the beautiful video From the Moon to Mars, The New Economics Part 1, which was narrated by Ouyang and which is right at the center of the website right now. So gentlemen, welcome to the LaRouche Show.
Thanks, Harley.
Hi, Harley.
Ouyang, what was the intention behind this new video? How were you thinking about it when you put it together?
Shot across the bow is basically what we wanted to do, is to have some kind of statement of intent and overall thrust, a lunge, around the policy of space exploration. But specifically, as a contribution to, you know, maybe beginning the process of lifting people's minds in the right kind of frame of thinking, rather than going through too much detail in terms of specific initiatives, but to sort of, I guess, set the parameters of what the discussion should be. And we found what was very useful for that were, you know, two things. One is LaRouche's writing, LaRouche's recent statements on the whole idea of using the concept of space colonization as viewed from a minimum of 50 years in the future to define what kinds of objectives we need today. But also the writings of Kraft Erika, who basically spent his whole life laying out for that kind of a program. And his specific focus was the conceptual and the philosophical foundation, the change in thinking that was going to be required to see that kind of a policy perspective through. And so we looked at a lot of different material. We looked took a fairly broad survey, although there's a lot of territory to be covered. We took sort of a broad survey of what is out there right now in terms of existing proposals, of what we've done, what NASA has done, but mostly what we could do, and we sort of took it as a point of as a point to make, which hopefully got across in the video, which is that you want to start with the question of what should we do, what does mankind require, and I think it's summed up pretty well in Erica's extraterrestrial imperative. So we take it as a starting point that this is an imperative. It would be arguing against the laws of the evolution of the entire solar system and the biosphere and the noosphere on the planet, the development of man and all of life on the planet. You'd have to argue against that entire process, to argue against the wisdom of going into space.
Well, Ouyang, one of the other questions that comes up, and I had a couple people I talked to who watched it, and both of them raised the same question. They said, well, I know that it was called the From the Moon to Mars, the New Economics Part 1. I sort of got it, but what is the direct relationship to LaRouche's economics with this? And you sort of mentioned this when you talked about how you use the future to determine the objectives today, but how is this an economic policy?
This is fun, because the question that I think it asking that question actually gets right to the heart of exactly what are the paradoxes that people run into in thinking about economics. You could take as a practical expression of this kind of mythical ratio that people have probably heard by now, that we got 10 cents for every cent or 14 cents for every cent that was invested by the federal government on the Apollo program. And those are true numbers as far as they go. But and as LaRouche made the point, you know, that's a return on investment that no other legal form of economic activity could ever net. So that was established. The real more interesting question is what are the underlying principles? Why does that work? Why was the investment in the research and development, the high-end scientific development associated with the space program, why did that have such a revolutionary effect on the entire civilian economy? And that gets to the core of the principles of physical economy, that when you organize the activity of the economy in such a way that the monetary considerations have no basis in allocating value. In other words, the question of value in an economy is absolutely not determined by any monetary considerations. That only comes in afterwards. But the value is fundamentally determined by a mission that has to be accomplished. And in this case, the mission, say, in our past experience, the mission was very well chosen. That Kennedy laid out, we need to go to the moon. And the people at NASA who saw that through had a much broader program that they were carrying out. And so it led to huge advances in all kinds of technologies, the creation of whole new industries and technologies, and really the education of, you know, a whole generation of scientists. So that's a starting point to begin to think about economics from the standpoint of a science driver, that's not a good economic policy by exception. That really should be the rule in organizing all of our economic programs.
And Peter, let me throw this to you, because one of the axioms that LaRouche takes up in this whole question is where people say, well, we can't even afford health care now, we can't afford to rebuild roads, we can't afford to keep our cities functioning, our schools open, how can we afford to spend money on space exploration? And Lynn turns that around by saying, we cannot afford not to do it. I presume in your thinking, that's one of the principles that's a starting point for this whole perspective also.
Yeah, absolutely. The future of man lies in space. As Ouyang was pointing out, in the Apollo program, the space program didn't make money. It actually made a whole lot of technological advances possible, which were used on the Earth. Like different types of materials, a lot of research was done in sustaining life in space, because you run into a lot of biological problems when you get into zero gravity situations.
Well, Peter, as you know, here in Houston, we have a whole huge medical center that got an enormous boost from the from NASA, including circulatory and heart questions, aging of tissue and so on.
Exactly. When you go into space and you have and you're in a zero, we're going to get to non-zero gravity situations in space soon, but when you're in space and you're experiencing so-called weightlessness, you start to exhibit types of degeneration that resemble like diseases of old age, for example, things like osteoporosis or heart problems. So a lot of, a huge amount of the research that goes into sustaining life in space travel is immediately usable for extending life on Earth, because you immediately run into problems that, you immediately run into things like unknowns that you have to solve. And if you have a national crash program to accomplish a specific mission, like going to the moon or something like that, then you're going to have the investment to solve these problems that might not quite get on the radar screen if we didn't have such a program. So the key for can we pay for, we can't even pay for, you know, things like stoplights and things like that on the Earth, or we can't pay for healthcare. The key is that if we go into space, we're going to be making the technological breakthroughs. The issue is not paying for things. The issue is, are we going to be able to make the breakthroughs so that the technologies are that are necessary become available for people on the Earth?
Well, this also gets at the question of how do you pay for anything? And LaRouche has been very insistent that as the monetary system that we live under today is disintegrating, we have to move to a credit system. So I presume that's a part of this whole question of the new economics.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Mr. LaRouche has made clear that that humanity has never lived under a fully functional credit system. We've always lived under monetary systems, which are essentially their equivalent to imperialism, empires, and so forth. We've never really had a credit system. We've had approximations of that in the United States, like under Roosevelt. Roosevelt put through reforms which were becoming approximations of a credit system, where he was paying for gigantic construction projects which improved life in the United States, like the Tennessee Valley Authority and so forth, by creating credit, which the United States government is unique right now in that our Congress is endowed with the right and the power, the sole power, to produce credit and direct that credit specifically in infrastructure projects and science driver projects. So if we were to go into space, we would have to have an initial enormous investment in rebuilding the industries and so forth on the Earth, which means we would have to get back to a credit system and wipe this monetary system off the books, so to speak.
You're listening to The LaRouche Show. We're talking today with Ouyang Teng and Peter Martinson. We're talking about the Moon-Mars mission. We're talking about the change in economic policy that's going to be essential, and that is essential not only because this would be a better system, but the system we're on right now is the Titanic, and it's going down very, very quickly. Now, we will take your questions. We have a long list of questions from Seattle, so I want to assure the LaRouche Youth Movement members that we will pick up some of your questions for Peter and Ouyang during the course of the program. If someone wants to ask a question of our two guests, send it to radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub.com. And we'll try and take up your questions, and if we don't have time, but they're good questions, I think Ouyang and Peter will be happy to take them up and respond via email. Now, Ouyang, I talk to people here in Houston, where we have the Johnson Space Center, people who are in their 60s now and who waited through the Bush years, figuring that as soon as Bush left, maybe we'd get a new impetus in space. And so far, they've been extremely disappointed by what they've seen from President Obama. A number of them are retiring because they only stayed in because they were hoping they would be able to get a new whole generation of Apollo-type missions going.
Yeah,
where do we stand right now? Where do we stand right now on NASA?
Well, I was going to say it's too bad that our campaign to send Cheney to Mars didn't quite make it off the ground in time. But
I think the Martians might reject him.
Yeah. But that's the biggest problem. I mean, I think that you could make the argument that was the biggest single that's the biggest single legacy or contribution, or maybe concrete contribution of, you know, the Apollo program back in the 60s was the development of the skilled labor force, the development of the scientific labor force. And that itself is a byproduct of the sort of inspiration that the whole program created in people to even go into these sciences. You know, there's Marcia Freeman, who has written about this for 30 years, has done, you know, has documented this. But there's, right now, there's a commission which was appointed by Obama to review, you know, review the whole U.S. space program, and it's something that they apparently do every time a new administration comes in, so they can put their own stamp on it and so forth. But right now, the outlook is pretty bleak as far as not so much the commission members themselves, but what they've got to work with. Within the budget constraints, which is a term that shouldn't even be used when talking about space exploration at this point, but within the budget constraints given by the administration, there's no way we can even fund the program that was set out by, you know, Bush or whoever was writing Bush's speeches to go back to the moon. It's a problem that is not so much in a technical or a programmatic problem from the standpoint that we don't know what we do. It's that people aren't willing to make the political fight. The compromise is when people try to say, well, look, why don't we appeal to the taxpayers by saying, you know, this only costs them so much money per year, and, you know, they spend that much on Oreos, so why not spend on the space program? That's really wrong. The idea that the space program costs anything is actually itself a false idea. There is no cost, no long-term net social cost of the space program because of the kind of growth potential that it creates. Now, the one caveat to that is that when we did this in the 60s, we had a huge level of investment in infrastructure and industry overall. So it's not a question of just allocating more money from somewhere else into the space program to solve our problem. It's a total approach that when Kennedy was combined with the tax credit, the investment tax credit for industry, and the fact that we had a really developed infrastructure that's now deteriorated over the last 40 years. You need all of that, but the point, I think, to make the fight on is none of those things in particular, but is the point that LaRouche has emphasized and is going to be central to this next paper that's coming out and should be on the website today, which is that these questions bring us into a domain that is fundamentally about what the sense of self-identity of the human species is, what the sense of identity of the individual is. And this gives the best, maybe most poetic expression in terms of a policy, in terms of a national policy, of what the proper sense of identity of a human being acting in the universe actually should be.
Well, Ouyang, you've basically identified one of the key problems, which is it's also a question of leadership, that you need to have leaders who have the foresight and the ability to think about these questions, which at this point, there's not a person really in the executive branch or in the Congress that's willing to challenge some of the axioms we were talking about earlier. But I'd like to ask Peter if you can tell us something about the idea of other countries now going into space. I don't know if either of you have much of a reading of this, but I know the Chinese have a program, the Indians have a program, I think South Korea is developing a program, Vietnam, even now there's a Mexican astronaut in space, and there's talk about doing something like this in Mexico. So it does appear as though there is a recognition in other parts of the world that this is where the future is.
Yeah. Last I checked, there were at the very least 10 countries that were putting out the call for an international mission to go back to the moon and beginning to put serious funding into it. Like, for, you mentioned China. China is planning on setting foot on the moon within the next decade. So Mr. LaRouche had, it's kind of funny the way he put it a week ago, right now all hell's breaking loose in the world. The economy is completely finished, and we're going to see chaos by the end of this month, unless we see some clear policy changes in the direction of what Lynn's saying. But the response from the sane people inside governments around the world is, let's get off this planet and go to other planets, go to Mars, go to the moon. Because a real sense of the future, which is a human thing, just because the United States is the only country that set foot on the moon, doesn't mean, let me put it like this. When we set foot on the moon, that was the most watched event in the history of man all around the world. People from all over the world were watching this event. And when Neil Armstrong put his foot on the moon, he said that this is, he essentially said this is not an American event, but this is an event, a milestone for mankind.
Right.
So the idea of going into space is something that countries, sane people in countries recognize is the kind of thing that will inspire the population. Even though things are worse now than they've ever been, that kind of a mission is what will inspire people to become optimistic again, and they would then support these types of plans. The only problem is we need to recruit our own country to get into this, because we're going to be the ones that are really going to be leading the space exploration, because we do have the prior experience at crash science driver programs, and we have a history of being a revolutionary nation.
Now,
so, but yeah, it is an international ferment right now.
Now, there are some specific questions I'd like to bring up just in terms of some of the problems, and Ouyang, you addressed some of these on the video, but we have a couple of them from Seattle that I thought I'd throw out there as well. The idea, actually, let me approach it this way. In Marcia Freeman's article that appears in the current Executive Intelligence Weekly on the LaRouche Pub website, it's written as though it's 2059 from Keplerpolis, a city on Mars, and discussing the difficulties of getting from where we are today in 2009 to where we had a colony of, I think she's at 500,000 people on Mars. Now, how do you get people beyond the idea that this would be science fiction? And one of the questions that came from Seattle is, how long would it take to develop an atmosphere on Mars? Is that something that's possible?
Oh, yeah, that's something we're discussing. It definitely has been taken up by, you know, it's something that's been taken up by the science fiction writers and other people who have speculated on it. What we've looked at just initially is how do you approach the solar system as a system, first of all. It's instructive to look at the biosphere on Earth as something which is not strictly a terrestrial phenomenon. In other words, it's a cosmic phenomenon. It was created by cosmic forces. And I don't mean in a mystical sense. I mean the clouds that you see today are likely generated by interactions, or partially by interactions of, you know, cosmic radiations from the Crab Nebula, with our atmosphere, with solar radiation, with the magnetic field of the Earth, which, by the way, Mars doesn't have. So the question of an atmosphere.
That's another question. Without an atmosphere, would radiation be a problem on Mars?
Yeah, I think a lot of these questions we'd want to formulate from the standpoint of having a much clearer view of the entire, what you might call the electromagnetic character, the electromagnetic environment of the solar system, which is something that we have a very dim view of right now because we don't have enough eyes in the sky. And it's going to take a different approach to thinking about these three domains that LaRouche has brought up over and over, in reference to the work of Vladimir Vernadsky, is the relationship, the interrelationship between the lithosphere, the abiotic or prebiotic inorganic physics, the living and the cognitive. And so we can take the experience of having done a real thorough analysis of the way that that develops on the planet, the way that you have the materials of the periodic table that are successively transformed through each of these phase spaces, from the abiotic to the biotic to the noetic, and to look at how that then is connected to the development of the periodic table in the first place from the processes that generated the solar system, which itself is something we won't know until we actually go to the other planets, the other celestial bodies, and dig around and do actual experimental work in it. And then from that standpoint, then you can begin to conceptualize the stages, the kind of evolutionary stages, which this time will be accelerated and directed by man. And I would say, you know, maybe one example where this might feed into is you take the example of photosynthesis on the planet. Plants developed an ingenious biotechnology to take the sunlight and convert it into chemical energy. Now, LaRouche pointed out a long time ago that the plants did the best they could with what they had, but it's a very low energy dense source. And you don't blame the plants for that. But now, and in the near future, with the development of fusion technology and other coherent, you know, electromagnetic technologies like beam technologies and so forth, we're going to reach concentrations of energy density and forms of power that are beyond anything that the biotics ever could produce. And that itself may be used to accelerate the process of evolution that we might need, that we most likely will need to think about, you know, terraforming Mars.
Well,
so I like the idea of helping, you know, helping nature out. You're actually accelerating the processes, you know, finding some way to deliver more energy-dense forms of power to life itself.
Well, isn't that the job of man?
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, Peter, one of the things that comes up in the question of this kind of space travel, and Lyndon LaRouche has talked about this quite a bit recently, is that with existing forms of chemical-propelled explosion, so to speak, and rocket engines, you have a real limitation. But how far are we from the actual possibility of developing fission or fusion capabilities for rockets? Because obviously, you've got to cut the time of travel if you're going to make any a serious effort to get to Mars. I mean, what does it take now if we were to go to the 1960s technology? How long did it take to get to the moon from the Earth?
From what I remember, it was about a day or two to get to the moon from the Earth. And that was from... How many days?
I think it was two or three.
Two or three days. But that was a non-accelerated trip. The way they do it is they make what's called an adaptation maneuver, where the craft is in orbit around the Earth, and then at the right point in its orbit, the rocket will fire to accelerate it, and then it'll stop, so that the craft is essentially traveling in a ballistic orbit until it gets to the moon, and then it will fire the rocket again when it gets there to get back and to get into the orbit of the moon. So you have these short bursts of thrust. Now, the current plans for getting to Mars, and that was fine because the whole trip took maybe a dozen days, 2 weeks.
But with Mars, you'd need constant acceleration, wouldn't you?
Yeah, the plans right now are to go to Mars in the same way, which would take about 7 months just to get there. And you're going to end up with astronauts that might not even be able to stand up if they landed on Mars. The real plans, well, Mr. LaRouche has been just hammering on, is if we're going to go to Mars, we have to have accelerated spaceships, which accelerate at a constant acceleration, the same as the acceleration on the Earth, one gravitational acceleration the entire way. So you accelerate up until halfway there, and then you decelerate the other half. so that you're constantly producing one gravitational force inside of the ship. That trip would take about 2 or 3 days if you were launching from the shortest distance between the Earth and Mars. Now, you run into a couple problems with this. One, if you're going to do that with chemical rockets, I think you need a fuel tank about as big as the moon. So that wouldn't work. But two, we don't know what types of effects we're going to run into with an accelerated ship, because we don't have anything in the solar system that's accelerating like that. We have things that we drop, you know, you drop something onto the ground, things like that. But we don't have large objects that are accelerating away from the sun or towards the sun at one gravitational acceleration. Everything is moving in these inertial paths, these Keplerian orbits. So what we would be doing is actually creating a new type of phenomena inside the solar system, which is an orbit that's an accelerated orbit. And the only place right now that I know of, the only clear example, Mr. LaRouche has been hinting at this, the only clear example in the galaxy that we know of accelerated material is in the Crab Nebula, where you have material accelerating. You have material, the observations that we have right now hint that the expansion of the Crab Nebula as a whole reaching speeds that exceed the speed of light, which is the so-called boundary speed in relativity. And what that suggests is that you have an acceleration process going on in the material inside the Crab Nebula, which are creating, we don't even know what kind of effects this is creating.
What kind of impetus would create something that could move at that beyond the speed of light?
Well, in the Crab Nebula, we're not exactly sure, but it has something to do with creation of matter in the universe. Mm-hmm. The way we would produce that is through either nuclear fusion power or so-called matter-antimatter reactions, which would be approximating the types of things that we hypothesize are going on in places like the Crab Nebula. And we've had programs back in the late 60s and early 70s during the Apollo program. There were experiments done. There was a whole program to put together a rocket which is powered by nuclear fission, a nuclear rocket. It was called the NERVA program. Mm-hmm. And the rocket itself was reaching several thousand pounds of thrust, which is, it's a fraction of what we can produce today with our biggest rockets. But the second generation of the project, which they were going to go into in 1972, would have hit the types of thrust that we get today with conventional rockets. And this is with a small nuclear reactor. Mm-hmm. Now, the program was shut down by the Nixon administration because of cost. And this is just one step in the process, starting in 1965, of shutting down aspects of the space program.
Yeah, it already began. Now, the shutting down already began before we got to the moon.
They were laying off workers in the project starting in 1965. We didn't even get to the moon until 1969.
And does that, Peter, does that somewhat, I'm sorry to interrupt, but does that somewhat correlate to what Lyndon LaRouche keeps saying, that the actual deceleration of the physical economy began in the mid-1960s?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's one of the reasons that the British saw John F. Kennedy as such a threat. It wasn't because he was printing treasury bills. That was one aspect, probably. But the biggest problem with Kennedy is that he was inspiring the United States to stand back up on its feet and think of themselves as they did under Roosevelt's time, Franklin Roosevelt's time. And the clearest example of that was the space program. So the shutting down of the economy in the United States, beginning in 1966, with the acceleration of the war in Indochina and so forth, it obviously included the space program. Because if you're going to try to demoralize and destroy a population, you're going to want to destroy that which is so inspiring, which is, you know, setting people on the moon.
Well, that was one of the points that comes through beautifully in the video that Ouyang narrated, which is that a major aspect of the space program is it reflects that universal optimism that should characterize human civilization, the idea that you're living for some purpose, some higher mission, as opposed to what happened in the mid-60s, which was the introduction of the whole rock, sex, drug counterculture and the concern with self. And so in a sense, we have, as a metaphor of that, a president whose main concern is how he looks, the Nero president. So clearly the interrelation of economic policy and this conception of how a nation functions to inspire young people to take up the tasks of the future is completely interrelated. Now, Ouyang, unless you have some thoughts on that, there's another question that came from Spencer and the crew up in Seattle, because clearly they're honing in on this question. I think they may want to leave Seattle for getting out of the solar system. But the question comes in from them, can the human body sustain acceleration of the type needed to get to Mars that you and Peter have just been talking about? What do we know about that? How much do we know?
Yeah, well, the 1G refers to the one gravity that we experience on Earth. And so we experience it on Earth not as an acceleration per se, but as a just as a gravitational effect of the mass of the Earth. So that is not a problem. The more interesting domain that this gets into, as far as the physiology, and by the way, I should note that Marshall Freeman wrote a whole book on this called Challenges of Human Spaceflight. So this is the experiments that they were doing on Mir and that they're doing on the space station. But the more interesting question is, we have a lot of data on zero-G effects, which are mostly bad over the long term. You have bone loss, heart deconditioning, other effects as your fluids redistribute throughout your body and weightlessness. And you know, a lot of research going into how to counteract the effects of that, how to do exercises while you're up there and so forth. And about the very, very long time it takes after, say, 6 months in space, back on Earth, the amount of time it takes to rehabilitate and build up your calcium levels and your bones and so forth. We also have, obviously, a lot of data on 1G physiology, since that's what we've all experienced the entire history of the human race. What we don't have, what we have virtually none of, is everything in between. The 1/6 gravity of the moon, the 1/3 gravity of Mars, and everything, all the other fractions between them. And that is one of the major areas of research that's going to need to be done before we, you know, set up shop on the moon and Mars. Is how, what's the threshold for the human body? What kinds of proactive measures can be taken? And I think in Mark's recent article that you pointed to, there's a very good sort of, a hypothesis about what that might entail, where she goes through, you know, the kinds of centrifuges you might set up on the moon. And, you know, hopefully I'd like to think that at least on Mars, the 1/3 gravity of Mars would be above the threshold for a lot of the bad effects, because, you know, you'd like to think we have a very bright and long future there without coming back to Earth as jellyfish or something.
Well, Marsha's article has a lot of really fascinating questions that are posed, including the one you just mentioned, the effects this would have on the physiological evolution of man. Often
yeah.
She raises the question of what happens to children that are born on Mars, grow up on Mars, could they sustain the gravity on Earth?
Right.
So these are all fascinating questions, and I think...
And actually, Erica has a funny, he has whole proposals on how, for space tourism, you might actually have zoos filled with animals and plants that are, you know, raised in zero or low gravity environments. People could come check out all these weird creatures.
Well,
so,
one of the older members here just asked before this program, does this mean that people would no longer have pot bellies? So I think
yeah, right.
Now,
we won't guarantee that.
Yeah. Well,
bad chance.
But people will be eating well, I'm sure.
Right, with all that freeze-dried food, you won't have to worry about it.
That's right. You're listening to the LaRue Show, and we're discussing the latest initiatives taken by Mr. LaRouche that address the question of the post-British Empire economy. That is, with the current system going through, you might say, its death throes, And we saw some of that this week. I'm not going to talk much about this on this program, but if you see the poor Joe Biden coming out talking about how great the stimulus plan is working, and the next day they release figures on the real economy, and we see 500,000 construction jobs have been lost in the United States since the stimulus plan. So good work, Joe. You're missing something. But at the same time, we're talking about the new kind of economy. And there's a question from Juliet for you. It's an interesting question. She says, what about the new space economy? What kind of effects would it have on our assumptions about how space and time work in their relationship to economics? And this is something that Mr. LaRouche has introduced in his last couple of papers, this idea of relativistic time and the work that's being done in the basement on Einstein. Could either of you just elaborate that a little bit?
Yeah, I can say what I think about it. One aspect is that when you get into relativistic space travel, in other words, accelerated space travel, we don't know what kinds of physical effects are going to occur on the ship in terms of the people on the ship. You might have wacky time effects there that we don't know about yet. Einstein forecasts that when you're in a gravitational field, time will slow down for you. But the types of effects that Mr. LaRouche is talking about actually get beyond any linear concept of time. In that, in economic time, let's say that we set up a colony on Mars that will begin, at the beginning, the support of the colony on Mars will come from materials flown there from the Earth. So at first, we're going to populate the space around Mars with robotic industrial craft, which can assemble types of bases and things like that you can set down on the surface of
Mars. Is that sort of like an upgrading of the space station or the Skylab, things like that?
They'll be much more advanced because they won't require people to be on them in order to maintain them and improve them. We're going to have to do a huge advancement in robotics and computing so that we can create machines that that you can program and have them construct new types of products that they weren't originally designed to produce, so that you can modify them at a distance. Now, when you're dealing with some place like Mars, the communication time varies over a year because our distance between the Earth and Mars changes over a year. Sometimes we're on the other side of the sun from Mars, and we have a very difficult time communicating with our satellites that are there now. So the time delay in simple communication will become a factor. But just transporting material there, there are two types of routes. You're going to want to accelerate your people, but then getting bulk materials to Mars is going to you're going to want to send that stuff on the inertial voyage because you don't want to expend so much fuel on that kind of thing. There will be like river barges, slow-moving craft. So your time will be constrained. You'll actually have, you'll have folds of time during which it is productive to send materials back and forth. There'll be times where it's not productive because of the configurations of the planets. So your idea of time will have to include the amount of space in between, you know, your two points of reference. We don't have that problem too much on the Earth because, you know, New York and Los Angeles are usually the same distance away from each other. But in space, you don't have that convenience.
Huh, that's interesting. So these are all considerations that people have been working on then. This is not just something that's new. I assume that people at NASA, people in the Russian space program have been working on these things. Now, let me throw in another question here, because there was just a conference in Prague that one of your associates, Jason Ross, attended, which was, I believe, the commemoration of the release of Kepler's New Astronomy. And it's clear to anyone who's followed the work in the basement that a lot of this work starts with the approach of Kepler to the discovery of the orbits of the planets. Now, today, how relevant is Kepler for this kind of work? Let me put it differently. What is the relevance of Kepler for the kind of thing that you've been discussing on the program so far?
I mean, I think it's one is that there's a problem that is going to come up in as human activity begins to actually encompass these scales that Peter was talking about, interplanetary, the interplanetary sphere of influence of the terrestrial economy. It's going to force a change in the way that we think about the map of the solar system. This is something that's actually ongoing right now amongst certain members of the basement, people who were involved in the work on the Gauss's orbit of Ceres. And that's the idea of what are we actually mapping when we discuss a map or a model of the solar system. Now, the conventional view of the model is sort of what you had in school, which was, gumballs or whatever it was, things flying around the sun in these ellipses. It's a sort of a geometrical model. And the first real step out of thinking in those terms, thinking in terms of a geometrical model, thinking in terms strictly of even a space that's, filled with these bodies, really is Kepler's work on what you might call orbital dynamics or solar system dynamics, which, culminates in what he has concentrated in the harmonies of the world, that he is never tied to a notion that you have a narrow notion that you have bodies, you have bodies moving in some kind of space in a certain amount of time. The way in which his laws are formulated is derived from a physical conception really of a space-time, something in which the laws of action are universal. Now, in what he was treating, universal in the sense of the solar system, but that you don't have pairwise interactions between the bodies, that you're dealing with a system that is organized as a whole, and so that everything that's within that system is subject to the laws of dynamics that he elaborates in the harmony. So I would say maybe the place where this is going to be, and Pete should probably speak to this, the place where this is going to come up and maybe the most interesting twist is the asteroid belt. It's the one region which Kepler himself identified as a sort of anomalous region from the standpoint of the orbital harmonies, where it was only later discovered by Gauss that you had what a lot of people hypothesized were the remains of an exploded planet, but in any case, you had what we now know as the asteroid belt. And the asteroid belt plays some functional role in the solar system. Our job is to find out what it is.
Well, Peter, I'd like you to elaborate on that, but I'd like to just start by posing a simple question to you. You studied astronomy as a college student and were pursuing this as a graduate student when you came into contact with Lyndon LaRouche and the LaRouche Youth Movement. To what extent are these kinds of issues that you and Ouyang have been talking about and the more what seemingly esoteric, but not esoteric at all, questions of going back to Kepler and rejecting much of these mathematical models that have been used. To what extent is any of this discussed in the universities and the graduate schools now in astronomy?
Well, I got a couple. I mean, one big thing is Kepler isn't studied in astrophysics courses anymore. You have to go to the history of science department. And in the history of science department, you don't have anybody who's absolutely serious about understanding Kepler's methods. For example, when Jason went to Prague to do this, it was the international conference on Kepler's new astronomy.
So he's a Kepler expert, so to speak.
Yeah, he met the supposed world expert on Kepler, a woman in England, and he got into a big debate with her about some of the points in the new Kepler's new astronomy, which this woman was completely off on. And the key was that she believed that Kepler did not proceed in this hypothesis from any notion of causes in the solar system. It was just purely mechanics. He was just doing purely mechanical, geometrical analyses, which just ignores an entire section of the book, by the way. Book 3 of the New Astronomy is all about Kepler's discussion of causes of the motions in the solar system, and he pinpoints the sun as being the cause of all the motions. So, but in the astronomy courses, the way they function today, you start with observations, which we have an enormous array of observations. We're sending telescopes up into space pretty regularly now, and we're building telescopes on the ground that are more powerful than the telescopes in space now. So the amount of sheer observational data we have of astronomical objects is it's mind-boggling. But the people who are looking at it in the astronomy, some of them probably mean well. You have a lot of people in the sciences who would like to be creative and want to make breakthroughs. But all of their observations have to be shoehorned into all the common models that you get from even the most basic astronomy textbooks. Like Ouyang just pointed out, you know, you look up in the sky and you're forced in the astronomy community to immediately put everything into a system where all the planets are orbiting the sun in elliptical orbits because they're all being pulled directly towards the sun by a Newtonian force. Now, the problem with that is that it doesn't explain anything. You're dealing with a model that's been given to you, and you're trying to put observations into that instead of come up with new hypotheses like Kepler did. And one obvious example is that the asteroid belt right now, we've done a survey of the recent literature. One, most astronomers are not interested in the asteroid belt because it looks like just a bunch of dead pieces of rock, which are small and not interesting. But right now, the astronomy community, they have no idea what the origin of the asteroid belt was. When it was clear in Kepler's works, he thought that there was a very, very fine orbit in that region. He actually put a planet in that region, in his Mysterium Cosmographicum. And you can tell that he was forecasting that possibly this planet exploded. But he put the planet there because of the harmonic considerations of the organization of the whole solar system. He didn't come up with some figmentary model such as Newtonian force, which is, you know, put into place after him. So now we have astronomers who, a lot of whom would like to make creative breakthroughs, and we find that a lot of them are interested in talking to us until you bring up issues like Kepler, harmonics, what is the cause of certain things in the solar system. Then they start to get a little bit freaky, but they like to, a lot of them do like to come up with new ideas, but they're stuck. It's almost like they have a type of disease that we have to cure, a mental disease that we have to cure.
Peter, it sounds a lot like what happens when you talk to an economist who acknowledges that the banking system's in trouble and then says the solution is more deregulation, that they're stuck within certain academic parameters or academic axioms. So as we've been discussing over the course of the last 50 minutes, what's become increasingly clear is that we're talking about material that's axiomatically revolutionary that you in the basement are pursuing. We have just a little more than 7 minutes left, and I just wanted to once again remind our listeners that Lyndon LaRouche will be giving a webcast this coming Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. That's Tuesday, September 8th, where he'll be discussing economics from this kind of axiomatically revolutionary standpoint. So in the remaining minutes, I would like to get back to this question. If there are listeners out there who wish to be a part of this discussion, wish to be part of the revolution in science, where should they start? What should they be doing?
Well, first thing is to go on the website, LaRouchePack.com, and download Lyndon LaRouche's newest paper, which I believe is being put up there today. He just finished it. And he spent about 2 months putting this together. It really is an instruction manual on how to understand what is the mental disease that, yeah, Harley, absolutely, it doesn't just infect astronomers today, but it infects everybody in society. Even
the whole culture, everything.
The whole culture. Mr. LaRouche makes clear what is this mental disorder called Euclidean geometry, empiricism, and so forth. What is the problem, and what is the solution to it, which includes this whole project of going to Mars. So I'd say first, download that. Download the video that we just produced that we're discussing from the moon to Mars. And definitely contribute money and get out and organize with us. Because unless we get the current administration to change direction fast, stop pushing things like genocidal medicine, we need our government to change directions fast and go in the direction of a credit system like Mr. LaRouche has been calling for, or else none of this is going to be possible, and we're headed swiftly into a dark age.
And Ouyang, what do you think? How are we going to get people into this kind of fight?
I mean, I think it's that there's a need for people to have a certain sense of internal judgment about the situation. I don't think LaRouche could be any clearer. I don't think his forecast could be any more validated in terms of a strategic analysis and in terms of laying out the policies that we need. What's, I think what's going to determine the direction that that those efforts go is largely going to be by taking on the conceptual challenge that that he's put in front of us. That, you know, science is not about a complete system. It's not about having some formal set of rules that you're going to operate by, because that's exactly the problem that most people in economics, in, you know, their social behavior, in science, that's where they've gone wrong, is trying to operate by some set of axiomatic set of rules. And I think that you have, right now, what we're developing, in the process of developing, is a certain open-ended approach to dealing with this on a systematic level. That if you look at the way that LaRouche has defined the problem with the of space exploration, you're encompassing a whole lineage of thinking and work that goes from Kepler all the way to Einstein. You know, on where does Kepler fit today? We can take Einstein's word for it in terms of the significance that he saw in Kepler's work in basically creating relativistic relations between the Earth and Mars when in the new astronomy, the way that Kepler is taking him, in a certain sense, taking the mind that is viewing the problem and making that the subject of deliberation, is the way, the process by which the mind is coming to grasp these problems. And so we've got, I think, in front of us a real powerful wellspring that under, you know, LaRouche's guidance, under the his contributions to this whole lineage, we really have everything we need in front of us to make the, you know, the axiomatic revolution that you're talking about. But it's got to be taken up at that level. We're sort of beyond at this point, you know, are LaRouche's predictions going to come true? Now we're at the point where the actual kind of thinking that is expressed by, that LaRouche expresses, that's got to become something that that people take on as a personal mission. And I think we've got all the raw material we need to do that.
Well, we also have the necessity, because this is the end of this existing financial system, and there's no way that you can survive unless you get off the Titanic. And it's very frightening sometimes to realize that your thinking is wrong, your approach to thinking is wrong, your view of man is wrong, and in a sense, you're jumping off a big ocean liner into a lifeboat in choppy, cold seas. But that's where we are. And I really hope that people who have been listening to this program got a better sense of the kind of scientific epistemological revolution that's being organized out of the basement, so to speak. Peter and Ouyang, it's been a pleasure having you on. For our listeners, go to the LaRouchePack.com website and watch the video, From the Moon to Mars, The New Economics, Part 1. Ouyang, I assume we'll have Part 2 coming sometime soon?
Yes, coming sometime.
Coming soon to a website near you. And don't forget, this Tuesday, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, Lyndon LaRouche webcast. And then compare what LaRouche says to the poor stooge we have in the White House, Barack Obama, who will be addressing the nation on Wednesday. I think the alternatives will be clear. So thank you, Peter and Ouyang, and to our listeners. You've just been listening to The LaRouche Show. Join us again next Saturday for the next edition of The LaRouche Show.